Mr. Whittaker, Reel 28. We were talking about the end of the war, into April 1945.
Yes. As I say, the routine went on. One thing did alter my routine slightly. Ironic. One day, the tractor driver brought me up the most magnificent book of drawing paper, A2 size, if you know A2, the biggest. I didn't know it was A2 then because we didn't have comic, but it was this huge, absolutely beautiful drawing paper and the most magnificent set of pencils I shall ever own, and I never used them. And these have been sent up to me by this prince of Liechtenstein who lived at what they call the Schloss. I used to send all my drawings down and he'd have a look at them. And he'd sent me up as a present, these things which were strictly forbidden. These were beautiful German, and there must have been about 50 in this box. And this was only a few weeks before the camp closed down. The writing was really on the wall.
Hang on, just while we're on the drawing, was it here that you burnt your drawings by mistake, or was that somewhere else?
It was in the space where I burned the drawings.
Could you just explain how that had happened?
Yes, all these drawings, you were strictly forbidden to have coloured pencils, and so I used to hide them. We had this stove in the kitchen, it was a flat, sort of hot plate thing, and at the end of it, at the bottom of the oven came out, and I used to put all my drawings wrap them up and put them in the bottom, and everyone knew about them, and it was first one in, take 10 drawings out, and guess who lit the fire one night? Yeah, me. Ruined most of them, some had gone. But I salvaged a few of them.
A bit charred at the edges. I've seen some of them, yeah.
Yes. The other reason we also used to hide them away at night, because one thing I just remembered, after the invasion, you'd get, in the middle of the night, you'd be woken up, and a voice would shout, "Norman," which means name. And this was the local Gestapo man. There were two types of Gestapo. One you had a hair flick with the raincoat, who you didn't know. And then they had them with uniform. And they had an office, a literary office in the village. And he'd walk all this way in the middle of the night because they'd been prisoners of war and swapped identities. I don't know if it was officers and people who swapped identities for the working party. And you had to have your name on your bed, a little cardboard thing pinned on your bed. So you'd wake up and invariably have this downright loser sticking in your eye and shouting name. And of course you were caught half awake, and you'd give your right name, you see. Or if you were Smith, he'd help you shout Jones. So that had that disturbed the routine. So, as I say, all this was all leading up, you know, we knew that they were getting very anxious.
So what was the final piece then?
I was delighted one day when instead of the lightnings, which were then, as I say, had begun to hunt even round our remote neck of the woods, single engine fighter, which I didn't recognise, a beautiful little aeroplane, they were bussing up and down the valleys, and me with my intimate knowledge of aircraft, and they must be close. I didn't know that the Mustang had got range of thousands of miles, that they could escort bombs to Berlin. These were single engine fighters. And, famous, one night when we were locked up, we heard gunfire, and this is unmistakable what you heard, it is rumble way off. And one of the lads, we could get out of the, I should explain, we could get out of the hut.
How?
We had a timber store, a cupboard inside in the kitchen, one up, one down, and the floors were loose. But there's usually so much wood that the guards were quite satisfied then hear us moving it. But it wasn't really the lads upstairs. In fact, they'd been out one night in the Badlands and killed one of the local pigs, which they soon got rid of. But you take all the wood out, you can lift the floor and then get out. And one of the lads upstairs this night, he actually, he couldn't really communicate with them except with shouting. But he went out and had a look, and he said you could see, you could actually see the, he'd see the flashes in the sky. And we persuaded the guard, when I say persuaded, he didn't get out of the dust anyway, and we actually did see, you could see the flashes on the horizon, and you could hear steady gunfire. And the guards, we've got one guard who didn't have a lot to do with us at that time. We've got two, and an elderly chap who was like us, he wanted to go home. And as I say, we did stay out and actually watch this, and I said, we'll be moving soon. So we made up our minds. We said, what are we going to do? And we said, well, this time, you could hear the guns in the daytime. And I said, oh, single engine fight. I said, they could only be a few miles away. So Jack Sykes, himself, there was a South African who joined us, called Jack Diamond, and I think there were a couple of English lads. People came and went in the camp. I should explain that Jack's pal had also gone, I've forgotten that. Dave Paul got his passport, the Red Cross. As I said, when you went, you fill in a form through an NCO, which was sent through the Red Cross, and you get confirmation from an NCO. Then if you wanted, you could stop doing it. Dave had got it and gone. So Jack was, his pal had gone. Anyway, Jack and himself and these others, we said, well, if the camp moves, we're not going. Said, we're not going to stop. We said, heaven knows how long it'll take. We said, the Russians are practically here. We'll take a chance with them. We chatted to some of the civilians who were, and they said, oh, we shouldn't wait for the Russians, you know, rape and pillage and all the rest. And they admitted that they knew from the news that they could hear the guns. Anyway, they announced one day, they said, it's finished, you're moving the next day. So we said, not us. So we.
You actually told them, or do you just said amongst yourselves?
We said amongst ourselves. We said, who's with us? And there were, I think, I know there was Jack and myself, and I can remember Jack Diamond, because he was quite a character. I think there were a couple of English lads who had not been with us long. And we decided we weren't going. We got all our Red Cross stuff and my magnificent drawing book and some spare kit. Tom from somewhere required a suitcase, which I didn't send back. And I packed these things in the suitcase. And that day, as I say, we'd been told, I actually took the suitcase with me and gave them to the Fierceman. As I say, the sort of foreman of the forest, and said, will you keep keys till I come for them? And he said, are you coming back then? And I said, oh yes, didn't tell him what we were supposed to do. But I said, we can't, you know, I can't carry them. The rest of the, that night, just before we hid a lot of the stuff among granite blocks just outside in this quarry. And come nightfall, we got out.
That way you said?
That way we said. Jack from upstairs, and some of from downstairs. And if you've ever been in a forest in pitch darkness, I can recommend make sure it isn't pitch dark, take a torch. It took us an age to find our stuff. We tried to put it where we could, by feel, pick these things up. Took an age to find it. We got, all we've got to live on, of course, tins of Red Cross stuff, food potatoes with scrowled. We reckon we could stick it out for a few days, and then, of course, the Russians would come and bingo. So we got our stuff together. That was, as I say, an inordinately long time, terrified that the guards would hear us. And we took off over the hills towards our old, the first job I worked on, which I set up this enormous hill. The tracks were quite different in the pitch and hop. We ran into every tree in the forest, I think. When we went downhill, at one stage we lost, we got to take the frying pan or something with us, and we managed to lose that. That took us, we don't know how long to find it. Anyway, we got over to where we thought was, we went down that valley and then up the side of the neck, and we knew there was a ruined house, foundation, which we thought would show there. And it snowed. Anyway, on the way there, we had, I shouldn't really tell this now, I should be shot for not trying to escape. We were going down this narrow road, middle of the night, early morning, and we heard somebody coming. So Jack was leaving, as a good sergeant should. We heard somebody coming and Jack, off the track. Jack was a bit in front of us, so we all dived to the side of the track, and to our horror, we heard this fierce, I forgot his name, was Desch, I think, D-E-S-C-H. And we heard his voice, Was machen Sie? Oh, God, it means, what are you doing? And, but the tension was broken for us because Jack, in inimitable style, said, I'm escaping. Oh, dear. We were in these bushes killing ourselves. We thought, well, that's it, you know, because we knew it always carried this automatic. And we thought, we said, well, what do we do? And we said, well, if he insists, we'll go with him. So we had a bit of a conversation, Jack, at this point. We said, well, what do you hope to do? So Jack explained we were going to hide until the Russians came. And anyway, to cut a fairly short story short, he let us go. He asked how many there were, and who were there were, and he didn't say good luck, he said be careful. And as I say, after we went, thinking that it was ridiculous, we hid out for a few days. We saw, on a couple of occasions, we saw German soldiers, which put the wind at us. We found a place, being a military strategist for them. I found the place where we hid, and we got a place, a spur, where it was very steep. So I said, well, if anybody gets us, they'll have to, we'd hear them coming up the hill. One night we did hear somebody behind us in the woods on the flat part, scratching in various whispers. So we whispered also, they said, you can't be Germans, or if they are the deserters, otherwise they'd come straight out and say, out. So we arranged and let them get close, and then we said, what will we do? We'll get out, pretend we've got weapons, and just say, don't let them get away, kill them. Which we did, we jumped and shouted, and said, as I say, in German, kaputt machen, there was a lot of weapons pushing them, they disappeared. Gunfire died away. No flashes at night, nothing. We began to run out of food. We were very chaotic with it. There was plenty of water. We came to run out of tea and food. One of the chaps said he wanted to call it a day, so we gave him a cup of tea. He said he was going to move and try and join the Russians. We found out after he walked straight down into the village and gave himself up. Jack went down one day to tell him what was happening. He managed to contact, I believe, some of the, I think you know, slots of people working, but the other civilians. He contacted them without, calling, without civilian notice. And they said, oh, the Russians aren't coming anymore, they've taken the enemy. Of course, I found out afterwards what happened. The Russians made a big fight towards Graz, got all the Germans down to the south of Austria, and then bam, it was there that they were after, which they. So we were stumped. We were out of grub, so we said, oh well, what can we do? We said, well, it's not much use trying to get anywhere. So we went and surrendered ourselves to Mr. Dash, to the fierceness. And they fed us quite well.
The same fierceness?
The same fierceness.
So you hadn't gone far?
No. The idea was to just wait in the region we knew fairly well, and then when the Russians came, just go and say, here we are, English, Tavarish. There was a couple of Ukrainians work nearby, and we'd ask them the words, we need Tavarish. But alas, we never saw the Stalin's troops. What I heard after was a damn good job, too. Anyway, we gave ourselves up.
Was there any trouble?
No, as I said, the first, his wife cooked us some food, and then he took us down to the local jail in the evening. He said, I've had time over, and he said he knew where we were. He said, I knew where you were all the time. And he said, we've had the Germans up here looking for deserters. And he said, did you see them? He said, yes, I've seen a couple. And he said, oh, both kaput. He said, what are they called? Schmeiser. And apparently, he said, I kept them. This was a small troop of Germans looking for deserters. He said, I kept them out of the valley where you were, because I knew you were there. He said, they'd have shot you. And apparently, when they saw these deserters, he said, they're just machine guns. And anyway, he took us to the local jail, where we found that our compatriot, who'd been going to escape and join the Russians, had put his name up the same day he'd left us. The old chap, the Fiercener, asked the policeman there, he had to give us to the police, the no troops left. He said, can't I just keep them? He said, they will end in a day or two. They said, oh, no, horrified, you can't do that. They thought we couldn't understand, but then we knew a lot more than they thought. Anyway, he said, you might just want to work for me now till the war ends. We kept safe. He said, good luck, and nice knowing you, this sort of thing. Left us in the jail. The next day, a German corporal came up and roundly abused us for wasting his time. He'd already marched. We'd been out about a week, I think, and he'd already marched to the rallying point. And he told us in own words, he said, I don't like to do this bloody job all over again. He said, I don't like walking. He took us down on the train to this place, Pegau, and they put us in a camp. And I did not, when we saw this camp, I had no idea it was there. I should explain, we'd been to the village several times, we used to take some pictures. For instance, after the invasion, they took us down to see how the Germans were beating off the invasion. And I hope that your museum have got the pictures. The most magnificent war pictures I've ever seen. They've done a bit of build-up, people on telephones, guns lifting skyward. But the big thing was when all of a sudden the scene shifted and there was the fleet. Millions of ships, barge balloons. All flashes. Oh, it was aeroplanes come, and the photography, that one of them particularly, it kept his camera for the rock steady with a twin engine bomber coming straight at him. And the shot, the bombs went over the top of the camera. And when this scene came on the show for Sweeney, they'd taken prisoners from all around the world, French, Russians. There was a terrific cheer in the cinema. Had quite the opposite effect of what they wanted. Anyway, back to the story. We'd taken through Pedro, and there was this camp, and over it was a dynamite skull and crossbones, the SS insignia. And underneath, there was this famous slogan which we had heard, the SS, Arbeit macht frei, work will make you free. The camp was run by a Ukrainian, built like an all investor. We were stuck, these four Englishmen were put us in a little, in a wooden hut. We did get our room, we got a little room at the end of the hut.
How many people were there altogether?
A few hundred.
And
there were mostly civilians, you know, forced workers who tried to flee.
There weren't many of you then?
There were some French who were kept entirely separate, and some Russians. But there were a few more British. About a dozen British altogether, but the conditions, the food was pretty basic. They had a good routine. In the morning, this Ukrainian bloke, or one of his henchmen, would rush down the room shouting, Aufstehen, get up. He had a rubber truncheon, a piece of rubber hose, and he'd hammer on the wall at the end three times, bang, 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 and those who weren't out of I can get them dressed, he'd beaten in the daylight out of them. It didn't bother us. Jack Diamond, who was a South African, he was a pretty canny sort of fella. And during the few days that we were there, he got on the right side of this Ukrainian. One thing I have skipped, when we left the camp and divided the Red Cross stuff up, I found to my horror that we'd appointed Herb Lawrence, the Australian, as the deputy confidence man. And he turned out to be just that. And if anybody says to me about Australian bastards, Herb was the one. I've got 500 cigarettes, which I've ordered for contingencies, and I hadn't got any when I came to collect them. And Herb confessed he'd pinched a lot. He dropped everybody's Red Cross parcels and personal parcels as well.
And he was meant to be keeping them safe.
And he was the man who didn't trust the Maori, who was our leader, the challenge man. So we got a few cigarettes left, what I've got, and we pooled resources. And to cut a long story short, we bribed this bloke and got better fed than the rest of them. They'd have you out first thing in the morning, and they marched us, and we were digging defences at the edge of a wood, under the supervision of the organisation Todd. I knew that because they had armbands which, you know, the old swastika, and on the caps that said LT. Now, they dug sort of big holes and interconnecting trenches. But when we work, even the guards who, they were the same Dabs Army people, and they didn't make it work. They were spread up with the rest. But they used to warn when that one chap suit, when he came along, everybody fucking down.
And this was all happening in April?
In April. There were one or two people shot. They had people to make sure he didn't run out the back. They had youths, young lads. 16-17-year-olds with the rifles, and they shot one or two people whilst we were there, and all they'd gone was they'd gone behind the tree to relieve themselves. They were a bit threatening to us, but, you know, they'd say, I'm glad you're so guarded and spit, tried to provoke them. of course, we kept out of the way. They were the most, I think they were some of the most dangerous people I ever met. A lad with a young lad with a life with them, you know, they, it's like this, it's just unloaded guns that almost killed them. These were loaded. Anyway, these few days, it seems like, looking back, it seems like months. We were certainly there a weekend, because at the weekend, during our cake battery, things like Bofors came by, they came in the tent. And one of the chaps was talking to us about listening to jazz in Berlin, asking us if they had any other jazz dancers. And they, one of the NCOs came and dragged him away, and he was put under close arrest for consulting with English prisoners. There were big signs, it was all barbed wire, there were big signs on it that said 2,000 volts or something. And I'm a real expert on electrics, and I said, oh well, you can't electrify barbed wire. Two of these attack people passed some cigarettes through the wire. It wasn't very deep, it was electrified, because one of them touched it, and it threw it in the air, and they cleared us off, but for some reason, they buried him in the earth up to his neck to earth him. I don't know what happened to him, because I said they locked us up, put us in the hook and told us to stay there. But hopefully, it didn't recover. But it was And of course, there, we've heard odd rumours about these camps. I mean, this wasn't a death camp, it was a political camp. But I talked occasionally with Chapel. Spoke with him, he was a hotel manager in Greece. And he said, you never have camps like this where they kill people. Talking to friends, he told me about people in the village. One chap, he said, oh, we soon got rid of him. He said, you see, Hitler rounded up all the Jews and shot them. He said, what? Of course, we didn't believe this. Oh, yes, he said, of course, so-and-so in the village, he says, we got rid of him. He says, he wasn't a Jew, but nobody liked him. So they simply said he was a Jew. And he also said, he says, the people were half-witted. Of course, all this, we'll have to gather these words. He said, they'd taken all them away. This was it. So, when they were talking to us, it began to make sense when this fellow was saying the camp's like, so we couldn't wait to get out. And one, after a few days, along comes the corporal, announces that we're off.